that Hebrew was supposed to be the sacred language, not the common language. That's true. But
well, I
Zionism
guess,
Zionism has changed all that.
Yeah. Well, more on all of this later, Anan, I trust. And
but we won't be speaking any Hebrew.
Plus ça change toujours la même chose.
Thank you. Hello, folks, and welcome to the March 19th, 2011 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you over the air on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM and also webcast worldwide at weft.org. The views and opinions expressed in this hour of programming are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WEFT's management, board of directors, or Prairie Air Incorporated. Now here's Tom with acknowledgement of some of our underwriters.
This hour of programming is being brought to you by you listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of the Maintenance Way. The Brotherhood of the Maintenance Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, the BMWE, celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is their hope that all workers may share the same benefits that they enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. The Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by you listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
All right, thanks, Tom. I'm your host, Bob Pilesny, here today with co-host Tom Thomas, who will have some workers' interest news for us. And later in the show, the Labor Hour Cultural Corner. Tom's poem for this week, from his Cries for Justice collection, will be Ireland is a Magic Land. Also here with us today is another co-host, Jason Kozlowski, one of the collective reporters, labor historian, and commentator. And I guess we'll get on with some labor news. Here's Tom to kick off some labor's interest news.
Wisconsin Secretary of State Doug La Follette has said he will delay publishing the state's new law limiting the power of public employee unions until March 25th. The last day allowed under state law. La Follette, a Democrat, said that would give local governments and unions time to work out new contracts before collective bargaining restrictions take effect. Republican Governor Scott Walker signed the law last Friday that requires public workers to pay more for benefits and bans negotiations in benefits, work rules, and issues other than wages. In Ohio, a similar bill entered its second week of hearings in the State House. Unfortunately, the Republican-controlled legislature is likely to approve it before an April 7th deadline. As a result of the Ohio actions, the University of Cincinnati's Ohio poll found that Governor John Kasich has the lowest approval rating at this point in his administration than any governor in the last three decades. 40% of those polled approved of Kasich, who is leading his party's fight to restrict collective bargaining, and 47% disapproved of him. Wisconsin Governor Walker's approval also declined dramatically during his battle against Wisconsin's unions. Jason?
Thanks, Tom. Related to this, courtesy of the New York Times, efforts to shrink collective bargaining rights for public workers in Wisconsin were slowed Friday when a judge issued a temporary restraining order blocking a much-debated law from taking effect. The decision, issued by Judge Marianne Sumi of the Dane County Circuit Court in Madison, temporarily bars the Wisconsin Secretary of State from publishing the law, which limits bargaining to matters of wages. The fight over the law has drawn tens of thousands of demonstrators to the state capitol, and the issue has become a focus of debate in numerous state houses. Publication of the law, a procedural requirement needed before it can take effect, had been expected next week, but Judge Sumi's ruling could delay that until at least later in the month when she plans to hold a full hearing on the lawsuit that accuses Republican lawmakers of violating the Wisconsin open meeting requirements to push through the bill. State officials said they were pursuing an appeal of the restraining order. The decision raised the prospect that Wisconsin legislators might be forced to take up the bill once again, but Republicans suggested it was merely a blip that was likely to be overturned. We highly doubt that a Dane County judge has the authority to tell the legislature how to carry out its constitutional duty, said Senator Scott Fitzgerald and Representative Jeff Fitzgerald, who are brothers as well as Republican leaders of the legislature, said in a statement. In addition to limiting bargaining to wages, the Wisconsin law limits raises to changes in the Consumer Price Index. It ends the state's collection of union dues from paychecks and requires most unions to hold annual votes to determine whether workers still wish to be members. Bob?
All right, here's a story I got from Working in These Times. This is by Lindsay Beierstein. and it's titled Shock Doctrine in Action, Michigan Governor Snyder Signs Hostile Takeover Bill. This week, the governor of Michigan signed a bill into law giving himself the power, through a state-appointed manager, to declare cities insolvent and hand them over to hand-picked emergency managers vested with the power to cancel collective bargaining agreements, fire elected officials, and call millage elections and dissolve a municipal government. Thousands of union protesters rallied inside and outside the state capitol as Governor Rick Snyder, a Republican, signed the bill late Wednesday. And when the governor appeared Thursday at an auto plant ceremony in Wayne, Michigan, celebrating the launch of the 2012 Ford Focus, he was booed by unionized workers. Snyder and his supporters claim that emergency management will only be needed in rare emergency. However, Snyder's 2012 budget all but guarantees an epidemic of municipal financial crises. The budget cuts $92 million in revenue sharing with cities and towns. Michigan already had legislation that allowed the governor to declare a fiscal emergency. However, under the old law, the local emergency financial assistance and loan board chose the manager. Under the new law, the emergency manager is chosen by the governor and serves at his pleasure. The new law gives the emergency manager the power to modify or terminate collective bargaining agreements between governments and public employees. Snyder's policies are setting up a conflict of interest. The more he starves cities and towns for funding, the more likely that they are to end up in financial emergencies. The more cities fall into financial crisis, the greater the governor's power to impose his anti-union agenda. Tom?
According to the Employee Benefit Research Institute 2011 Retirement Confidence Survey, a lot more workers are a lot more pessimistic about their retirement futures than at any time in the past two decades. The percentage of workers who are not at all confident about saving enough money for a comfortable retirement has reached 27% for 2011, compared with 22% the same time last year. When combined with those who said they are not too confident, the total reaches about 50% of all workers. Among the findings of the EBRI survey are that the number of workers who are saving money for retirement dipped slightly from 60% in 2010 to 59% in 2011. On the dark side of the savings issue, quite a few workers have virtually no savings or investment capital. In 2011, 29% of those surveyed said they had less than $1,000 in savings, and 56% said that their savings and investments, excluding their home value, totals less than $25,000. The number of workers who have dipped into their savings to pay for their basic expenses or to take a loan has reached 34%. Said Greg Burrow, Senior Vice President of Retirement Investor Services at the Principal Financial Group, a partner in the EBRI survey, "This is sobering, and hopefully it will stir some action." Jason?
This is courtesy of Labor Notes regarding an SEIU strike at Pennsylvania Hospital. Nursing techs, service, and maintenance workers at Pocono Medical Center escalated the defense of their union with a three-day strike this week. Members of Service Employees Healthcare Pennsylvania, the workers walked out March 15th to show unity against management attempts to impose an open shop and contract negotiations. The strike follows an earlier one-day strike that occurred February 9th. Unionized nurses in the hospitals have been speaking out in support of their coworkers, joining rallies, and holding a picnic for strikers. Other SEIU locals from Pittsburgh, Ohio, and California have sent donations. The 550 PMC workers voted in a union 4 years ago and have been negotiating their second contract, which expired in October. Management has been trying to push the open shop poison pill into the contract in which workers could get the benefits of the union without paying dues. After months of stalled negotiations, the union tried to meet management halfway, offering that members could opt out of the union during a five-day window, but, quote, "they said it's all or nothing," end quote, said Madeline Vasquez, vice president of the union chapter. The PMC management assault echoes battles in a dozen states this year over right-to-work-like bills. In right-to-work states, where workers can get the benefit of union representation without contributing, the union's ability to advocate is weakened, lowering standards and eventually hurting the whole workforce, including those who thought they can get a free ride. And, as in state battles, it's more about seizing power than saving money. Vasquez said, quote, "it's not costing them anything. It's our money that pays dues," end quote. A weakened union would, of course, save the hospital money in the long run. Workers at PMC are particularly concerned about workload issues. Vasquez, a health unit coordinator who has worked there for 8 years, said some nursing techs in the hospital have a territory of 28 patients, while dietary workers may handle several floors. Bob?
Okay, here's another story from Labor Notes. This is by Jenny Brown, and it's about the Indiana anti-worker bill skids to a halt. Hoosier unionists, bolstered by exiled Democratic members of the Indiana House, have brought a wagon load of anti-worker bills to a standstill. Crowds numbering from 1,000 to 10,000 have swarmed the Indianapolis State House every day for almost 3 weeks, leading Republicans to say they will shelve the right-to-work bill that started the tumult back on February 21st. Some unionists thought dropping right-to-work was a ruse to tempt Democrats back to the state. If it was, the trick failed. The Democratic caucus, dug in at a hotel in Urbana, Illinois, is focused on blocking 11 bills under consideration. Meanwhile, the protests have continued with teachers, steel workers, state workers, laborers, food workers, teamsters, electrical workers, bricklayers, and carpenters visible in the crowds, hanging banners in the rotunda and making music, so much the police restricted playing hours. Now, Indiana's House requires a two-thirds quorum to move any bills, so Republicans can't dodge the Democratic walkout as they did in Wisconsin. The Indiana Democrats, who hold 40 seats out of 100, have some flexibility because not all of them need to be absent at any one time. So two are generally at the State House to make procedural motions, and another one has never even joined his colleagues in Urbana. So, Tom?
Hey, President Barack Obama asked Congress last Monday to rewrite the nation's main education law before the start of the new school year in September, setting an ambitious timetable for lawmakers who are now focused on budget cuts. He also issued his most detailed outline yet for changes to the No Child Left Behind law. Obama said the law, which was enacted in 2002, got some things right, but also got a lot of things wrong. He cited the law's promise of putting quality teachers in every American classroom and requiring accountability from every American classroom. At an Arlington, Virginia middle school, Obama said, "The rewrite is the right thing to do. What has not worked is denying teachers, schools, and states what they need, particularly financially, to accomplish their goals." Jason?
This one from Canada. Weyerhaeuser Company Limited has been summoned to appear before a provincial court judge in New Westminster on March 28th regarding United Steelworkers' private prosecution for the death of sawmill worker Lyle Hewer in November of 2004. Prominent criminal lawyer Glenn Orris will appear as prosecutor for the union, which is pursuing charges under the 2004 Westray Amendments to the Criminal Code of Canada. Weyerhaeuser has retained criminal lawyer Leonard Doust of international law firm McCarthy Tetro. The judge issued an order on March 2nd in the private criminal prosecution case. The union alleges Weyerhaeuser was criminally negligent in Hewer's death at the company's New West Division sawmill. Hewer died horrifically after being trapped and asphyxiated by debris in a hopper connected to a hog, a machine that converts wood waste to chips. He was rushed to Royal Columbian Hospital, where he succumbed to injuries. Hewer died from injuries incurred after following a supervisor's request to work under the conditions the employer knew were hazardous. United Steelworkers Western Canada Director Stephen Hunt said, quote, "We expect that our union will either proceed on its own in the role of a private prosecutor or that Crown Counsel may step in to prosecute the criminal case," end quote. Over 3 days of hearings in October and November 2010, 23 witnesses gave evidence before Judge Alexander in New Westminster Court. Previously, the council had rejected New Westminster police recommendations that a charge of criminal negligence causing the death was warranted. Bob?
Okay, here's another story from Working in These Times, and this is by the excellent reporter Mike Elk. And it's titled, "New Competition for Teamsters as Obama Allows Mexican Truckers into the U.S. The administration implements a NAFTA clause even as public support for unions is rising. When the North American Free Trade Treaty passed in 1994, there was a clause allowing truckers from all three nations to freely transport goods throughout the continent. However, for the last 17 years, forces in organized labor, led by the Teamsters, have worked to delay implementation of this rule, claiming that Mexican trucks are unsafe and the truckers are paid significantly less than American truckers. In 2007, the Bush administration started a pilot program to allow a few truckers into the United States to see how the safety concern worked out. In 2009, with Democrats back in power of the White House and Congress, Congressman Peter DeFazio, Democrat of Oregon, led an effort to defund the pilot program monitoring the safety of the trucks crossing it. This move stopped Mexican trucks from entering, from coming across the border. And Mexico, upset by this move, slapped more than $2 billion worth of tariffs on 100 American products, putting pressure on the Obama administration from agricultural state politicians. So earlier this month, the Obama administration announced that it would start a new program to allow Mexican trucks to ship goods across the United States border. The Mexican trucks would be subject to strict safety controls. After 18 months of monitored operations within the United States, Mexican truck companies that meet the standards would be allowed to operate freely inside the United States. Now, many union advocates believe this is problematic because Mexican trucks could transport goods around the country while paying Mexican wages significantly below American wage standards. The likely result? Lower wages for American truck drivers. Teamsters President Jimmy Hoffa Jr. says, I'm strongly opposed to this agreement. Why agree to a deal that threatens the jobs of U.S. truck drivers and warehouse workers when unemployment is so high? So Mike Elk concludes, what's even more troubling is that at a time when union support is surging in the wake of Wisconsin, President Obama is working behind the scenes against the interest of union members by pushing to open the border to Mexican trucks. And we've been joined by original co-founder of the Illinois World Labor Hour, Bill Gorell.
And millions of workers wonder, will he ever find his comfortable shoes? That for those you haven't seen, maybe I can find some audio of that and we can play it later. It's he gave a speech at one point during his campaign running for office where he said if workers' rights were threatened, he'd be out on the picket lines with him after he got his comfortable shoes out.
He did say that. So, and we understand that Dave Johnson, the primary host of Illinois World Labor Hour, is listening in today. So we say hi to Dave, and I think we're going to go to a little clip here from Jim Hightower Radio. So,
every state legislature has its share of incompetent, insensitive, and often incomprehensible goobers sitting in seats of power. Sometimes you have to wonder who helps them work the doorknobs to get out of their houses each morning. For some reason, Texas seems to have more than its share of grade-A goobers serving in our state capital. One is Debbie Riddle, a right-wing Republican ideologue from the town of Tomball. Representative Riddle is presently in a pout. She's offended that so many people have been offended by an immigration bill she introduced. It calls for fining and jailing people who, quote, intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly hire undocumented immigrants. Okay, that's a pretty popular position in our state, but then she stumbled and tumbled by adding a little exemption. People who hire unauthorized laborers to work in their homes will not be fined or jailed. Yes, it's a nanny loophole for the privileged class. They rail about people they callously brand as illegal aliens. Yet, they want a steady supply of these low-wage powerless workers to care for their children, clean their houses, and tend their yards. They don't want to mess with checking documents, so Debbie blithely gives them a pass, allowing them to hate illegals and have them too. How happy! She then demonstrated her deep grasp of the immigration issue by explaining that Latinos are coming into our state illegally because we put, quote, a big old bowl of candy out for them. Yeah, Madam Lawmaker, those housekeeping and yard jobs, as well as chicken plucking and roofing jobs, are plenty cushy and well-paying, which is why so many of your neighbors are scrambling to grab such work for themselves. This is Jim Hightower saying, pious politicos should try walking in the shoes of people they denigrate before they legislate. Reality can be a useful teacher if you're willing to listen to reality.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
set them straight. I'm gonna even things up. I'm gonna set things straight. I'm gonna lock all the doors. So you can't skate. Well, the tables are turned. I can't wait. Gonna even things. I'm gonna set them straight. Gonna even them up, baby.
Collectively bargain, when I'm in the White House, I'll put on a comfortable pair of shoes myself. I'll walk on that picket line with you as President of the United States of America. Because workers deserve to know that somebody's standing in their corner.
And that was a little clip there from President Obama, courtesy Bill Gorell. And we've come to that part of the program.
Actually, Fire Dog Lake uploaded that to YouTube.
Excellent.
FireDogLake.com.
Yeah, that's a good website, too. We've come to that part of the program, the Cultural Corner. This week, Tom's poem from his Cries for Justice collection will be Ireland is a Magic Land.
Ireland is a magic land of beauty lush for all to see, created by her people's hand, an earthly paradise to be. From Dublin's cobbled alleyways to Knocknashiga's misty height, bright butterflies and singing jays and magic blossom day and night. Ireland has a living soul that even Cromwell could not turn, back when he played the tyrant's role for which in hell he does now burn. Ireland is a magic land, a jewel in a turquoise sea, where people proud and ready stand when they've decided to be free. Aye, she did suffer in her times, as all her children sought to be, no longer victims of the crimes of an occupier's tyranny. Now there's no royal family to burn a witch or steal a farm. The Irish chose democracy to deliver them from that harm. Leprechauns dance in the clover, the willowed hills hide unicorns, moonlit nights banshees fly over, and fairies sing on golden morns. Ireland is a magic land of beauty lush for all to see, created by her people's hand, an earthly paradise to be. Ireland is a Magic Land was written at the Poets Loft in Champaign, Illinois on March 13, 2007 and was brought to you live today, March 19, 2011 on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois.
Thanks, Tom. I want to make a little comment there. If you might have heard Tom refer to Cromwell, that would be Oliver Cromwell, leader of the Roundheads, who held the Glorious Revolution and wanted to make a united Protestant church within England and got rid of he fought the Parliament. Well, I was doing some research. It turns out my ancestors were on the wrong side of that, and Cromwell kicked them out and sent them to Ireland, where they stayed until the 1700s, and they went to Virginia.
That's the same thing that happened to the Thomas family. We got run out of Wales to the part of Ireland, and then in 1689, the first Thomas is landed in Culpeper County, Virginia.
Well, good golly, man. Maybe we go a lot farther back than we know.
That's a strong possibility.
We want to remind you, too, to tune in to Labor's View TV show every Sunday at 4 o'clock on Cable Channel 6 locally with one of our hosts, David Johnson, and friend of the show, Jim Imond. That's every Sunday, 4 o'clock on Cable Channel 6, Labor's View TV. And I think we'll go into a quick little snippet from Workers Independent News here. They are out of Madison, Wisconsin, and they typically have good reports going on what's happening in Wisconsin.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. A Dane County, Wisconsin judge is expected to rule Friday on a motion seeking an injunction to block the state's law gutting collective bargaining for public workers. Dane County's district attorney filed the case, seeking to block the law by contending its passage violated the state's open meetings law. Judge Marianne Sumi will rule on a temporary restraining order today. If the judge grants it, Wisconsin's Secretary of State will be temporarily blocked from publishing the law. That's the final step in putting that law into effect. A separate legal action seeking to block the collective bargaining law has also been filed by Dane County Executive Kathleen Falk. Republicans in Wisconsin's legislature used a highly unusual and possibly illegal series of parliamentary steps to gut collective bargaining for public workers without a single Democratic state senator involved. The legal challenges seek to block the law, and a recall effort against 8 of the Republican senators is underway. The Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, has won an arbitration ruling for hundreds of former Midwest Airlines flight attendants. The union had charged that an existing union contract was violated when Republic Airways Holdings bought Midwest and staffed flights with non-Midwest attendants at up to 70% less compensation. The arbitration ruled the contract was violated when the hundreds of flight attendants were laid off. Now a remedy must be decided. With the possible passage of the Korean Free Trade Agreement hanging over the House of Representatives, a number of Democrats have begun to mount an effort to have the agreement changed so it doesn't end up being a backdoor for a flood of Chinese imports. Jesse Russell reports.
California Representative Linda Sanchez is a member of President Barack Obama's Export Council. She said the goal of her council is to double the number of American goods being exported and not to export American jobs. Unfortunately, Sanchez said during a press conference on Wednesday, that's exactly what the current agreement will do. She said Wall Street is in love with this agreement.
It loves the investment provisions that provide incentives to build factories in Korea rather than here in the United States. And Wall Street has successfully blocked the efforts of the House Trade Working Group to make this deal better for small businesses and working families.
North Carolina Congressman Larry Kissel said the Korean Act will have the same impact as NAFTA.
We can do better than this. This is not a matter of protectionism or just being against something. It's saying we can do a better deal We can reward the folks who want to do it here. It's important that we make things in America and reward those folks.
This newscast made possible in part through underwriting from the AFL-CIO. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Okay, excellent report there again from the folks at laborradio.org. Just a quick note, we started the song with our our usual theme song from Pete Anderson, Working Class, and then just before Tom's poem, we heard another Pete Anderson tune, Even Things Up, from his brand new CD. And now Jason's here with a special guest in the studio. Jason?
Yeah, we're glad to have Leighton Christensen here along. He's a colleague of mine over at the University of Illinois. Leighton's a graduate student at the University in Library and Information Science. As a labor activist in the last 25 years, he's been involved in various solidarity campaigns, such as in Decatur, Illinois, and the war zone struggles of the mid-90s, the UPS strike of 1997. Leighton was working as a truck driver. He was first a member of the Chicago Truck Drivers Union and later Teamsters Local 710. In 2009, he was a member of the GEO strike committee that led us grad students out on strike when the university was stalling bargaining. Leighton, great to have you on the show.
Thanks, Jason. It's great to be here.
So tell us a little bit more about your background, especially since this is great stuff, but especially as a labor activist and an activist for 25 years, what sort of things you got started in and what got you involved in activism in the first place?
Well, back in 1986, I was at the University of Iowa in Iowa City and joined up with activists there with the group, the International Socialist Organization. I was at my first picket line 3 weeks into classes my freshman year, six o'clock in the morning, which is ungodly hour for freshmen, with the iron workers on campus who were trying to keep a new construction site at the medical clinic unionized. And one of the very first things we did was block the 7-Up truck from making deliveries and the garbage truck from coming in to pick up garbage. And from there, things just kind of happened. If you know your history of the Midwest in the 80s and 90s, you'll know that there were numerous attempts by the Ku Klux Klan to organize in Dubuque, in Janesville, in Rockford. And we opposed all of those. We chased them out of town in Dubuque. We chased them out of town in Janesville and Rockford. We successfully defended the abortion clinics in Iowa City from the right-wingers who came in. We chased them out of town on different occasions and made it a whole different environment for women seeking their rights in Iowa City. And then, you know, just as things come up, you call us up and we come out. So it marched in Des Moines, Iowa with rubber workers on their picket line. And the funny thing is everybody's always say, oh, they're surprised, like, how is this all happening in Wisconsin? Who would have ever thought? Well, as somebody who's been organizing in the Midwest for the last 25 years, I'm not really surprised. I've seen that sort of spirit around before, and I'm sure we'll see it some more.
Yeah, I think no doubt about it. What brought you to the University of Illinois, and have you been active in the local really from the get-go?
Yeah, I came to the University of Illinois in 2009 to start the graduate program in library science. I'd been truck driving on and off for 15 years, and that's a terribly soul-crushing job, and decided that I'd had enough, and my back was killing me, and my knee was bad, and, you know, this, that, and the other thing, and decided I needed a job I could actually live through. So decided on digital preservation, so came here to school, and things have been pretty slow in Iowa City for the last couple years, activity-wise, politically. And come here to the University of Iowa or University of Illinois, and there's a strike going to happen in a couple of months. And it's like, well, I have to be a part of that. And was steward at the Library and Information Science Department just as soon as I could volunteer, and I've been working with the GEO ever since.
Were you surprised by the level of activism and solidarity that had developed here? And what were your impressions, too, of the way that the strike, which was a two-day successful strike, had played out?
Well, you know, I've been an activist and union member for off and on for 25 years, and I actually had to come to graduate school to actually be in a strike where my job was out on the picket line. So that was surprising. And the GEO is unlike any other union I've been a member of. As the grad students, the activists in the union, they know their labor history. They're committed to social justice. I'm really surprised by the level of spirit and knowledge among the grad students. Like I said, I was a member of Teamsters Local 710, where our local president, Frank Soule, this was back in the 90s, was paid $500,000 a year to be a local president, not even Jimmy Hoffa. And that union was run very top-down. Members weren't encouraged to participate. I can say that three-letter word, a little mobbed up, without irony. So the GEO is a very different experience, and wonderful union, wonderful bunch of people to work with. Very proud to work with all of them.
Yeah, I could certainly attest to that, and it's easy to say because we're members in a way touting union, but it really is truly a very bottom-up organization in a way that I think is a model for that in so many ways. What other than your interests, but what exactly was it that drew you to the events in Wisconsin, and at what point was it that you got involved in the solidarity work up there, which was quite extensive? So at what point were you involved, and what have been the various things that you've been doing here and in Wisconsin?
Wow, that very first week, as soon as the occupation started in Madison, I was itching to get up there, and it took a while to get myself organized, to get my life organized here, and got up there during the second week. So at the end of the first week of the occupation, I was up there on a Wednesday during the occupation of the Capitol. So it wasn't any of the big rallies, but it was sort of the day-to-day occupation stuff that's, I think, tremendously important. And I was so inspired by what I saw up there on that Wednesday. People had, people had obviously organized the occupation, the sleep-in, and the teachers had been doing their rolling sick-out the week before. But things that had been forgotten had been spontaneously organized, things like food distribution, things like first aid, things like childcare. Because, hey, you still got to have some place for the kids, even when you're occupying the Capitol. And that was all something that, the grad students of the TAA, some of them overlooked, but that the folks in the occupation organized themselves, came up with on their own. And it really showed in the spirit of the occupation. You're in the rotunda, there's three floors, there's thousands of people chanting, this is what democracy looks like. There's signs linking the struggle to what had been happening in Egypt just up to that point. An old Solidarnosc banner from Poland. It was absolutely mind-blowing, some of the signs and the amount of solidarity up there. And so I think getting a chance to talk with those people who, are various opinions about where to go and what to do next, whether it's enough to compromise, whether we need to kill the whole bill, whether we need to recall Walker, whether we need to push until Walker quits now. All those sorts of debates are in the air in Wisconsin. And so being there during the occupation, being part of that discussion in a way is much more exciting for me, much more useful. And then getting a chance to talk with people and hoping to push things a little bit to the left and open up some possibilities for folks.
How long were you up there? And there's a piece I want to get to later that I had posted to our Labor Hour blog, which was just tremendous. But how long were you up there at any given time, or was it mainly you're going back and forth? And by the way, there were a good at least 100 GEO members who had been spending some time up there, and you were certainly one of them. But were you there for longer periods of time, or was it more back and forth?
I've actually only been up there for 2 days. I was up there on that Wednesday, and then I was up there again Sunday the 27th during the night when the cops were first going to throw everybody out. I stayed for that occupation and stayed into the night. But the wonderful thing about being a member of the GEO and the ISO is that hundreds of your brothers and sisters and comrades can be there and be active and, carry, similar ideas and politics forward into the fight. And you personally don't always have to be there. You just have to help organize other people to get there. So I haven't been able to get there as often as I like. But, the next challenge is bringing what's happening in Wisconsin to Illinois, and that's just as important.
Yeah, no question about it. One of the things that I had posted, you had sent in an email, and I had posted it to the blog, which was great, and you were talking about you're having gone up that Sunday, I think it was. And spending the time in the rotunda and talking about your impressions, and you've given us a good glimpse of this, of what it was like. But you really recounted some excellent things, and especially the way that you culminated this, of where the workers who were in the rotunda, were basically being cheered on, where there was this particular combination of protests while also work is going on, as you were allowed really to stay in there. So rather than my reading it, if you wouldn't mind recounting some of this stuff, and especially these interactions, which I think are really tremendous and convey an awful lot of the spirit of what was going on in the rotunda, if you wouldn't mind sharing that.
Absolutely. My two favorite moments from the time in the rotunda, the one on the Wednesday, when three busloads of folks came from L.A. They'd been on the bus for at least 24 hours. 150 people from all sorts of different unions in Los Angeles walk into the rotunda, and the rotunda was loud before. Suddenly, the noise increased so much, the cheering, the chanting, that you could feel the sound come back down from the walls, and you could feel the pressure of the sound. It was an amazing thing.
Excellent.
And then on Sunday, it was a very different scene. I mean, we went from thousands of people in there Wednesday to Sunday night. The cops are threatening to kick us out. We've just, hundreds of people have stayed in deciding, well, we're going to chance it. We're going to make them make that decision. We're going to make them spend the resources and time. And we had four or 500 folks in there, and they decided, well, that's too many. So they decided not to arrest us, and that we could stay in that Sunday night. So we beat them back that one time. And as you alluded to, work still has to go on in the Capitol. Even though there's thousands and thousands of people in there, floors have to be washed, garbage has to be collected, the janitorial staff still has to do their work. And so it's 9 o'clock on a Sunday night, and the woman janitor there rides out on her big floor-washing Zamboni-like thing into the center of the rotunda. We've cleared out so that she can wash the center of the floor. And she starts going around in a circle. And I can imagine that never in her life have 300 people watched her at 9 o'clock on a Sunday night wash the floor, right? This is a completely weird experience for everybody. And not knowing what else to do, people are sort of watching. And we joke about what's going on in Madison, and we call it the thank you revolution sometimes. I like the cheddar revolution, but the thank you revolution sort of speaks to the spirit of the folks in Wisconsin. People start chanting thank you to the janitor as she's riding around on the floor. And she gets a big smile on her face, and she comes by, and she gives my comrade Ashley a high five on her way by. And she, she's doing a tightening spiral into the center of the star in the center of the rotunda. And any of you who've ever held, a job where you work with machinery or tools of any sort, you all have this little trick or stunt that you do with your tools or with your machine to show off your mastery. You do the little thing with the forklift or with, I was a truck driver. When the boss wasn't around, or maybe it was just me and my closest buddies, we'd go out and we'd fool around with the equipment, hoping the boss wouldn't catch us. Because sometimes you got to have a little fun at work. So the janitor, she gets into the center of the circle, and she's finishing up. And this has been going on for about 5 minutes, watching her go around, because the Zamboni doesn't go very fast. And she gets to the very center of the star. She does this tight little 360 spin and shoots out of the columns of the rotunda, and everybody applauds. It was almost as loud as anything else had been the entire time, and it shows you the spirit that this worker felt close enough to the 300 of us that she could show us that little thing that usually you only do for yourself, that she shared that with us, and that was quite a moment for me.
Excellent.
Yeah, it's just great stuff.
I think we're going to go to some music here?
Yeah, I think it's a good idea. And we'll come back with Leighton to wrap up the show.
All righty. Something from Dropkick Murphys. This is Take 'Em Down, and this is their song they did in support of the Wisconsin Public Employee Unions fighting the governor's attack on collective bargaining. So.
Put us down. When the boss comes calling, gotta stand your ground. When the boss comes calling, don't believe their lies. When the boss comes calling, he'll take his toll. When the boss comes calling, don't you sell your soul. When the boss comes calling, we gotta organize. Let them know we gotta take the bastards down. Let them know we gotta smash them to the ground. Let them know we gotta take the bastards down.
home, you'll be on your own. When the bus comes calling, will you stand alone? When the bus comes calling, will you let them in? When the bus comes calling, will you stand and cry? When the bus comes calling, we must unite. When the bus comes calling, we can't let them win. Let them know we gotta take the bastards down. Let them know we gotta smash them to the ground. Let them know we gotta take the bastards down. Down. When the bus comes calling, gotta stand your ground. When the bus comes calling, don't believe their lies. When the bus comes calling, they'll take your soul. When the bus comes calling, don't you sell your soul. When the bus comes calling, we gotta organize. Let them know, we gotta take the bastards down. Let them know, we gotta smash them to the ground. Let them know, we gotta take the bastards down. Let them know.
All right, Dropkick Murphys there. Take the bastards down. And we're back with Jason and Leighton.
As only Dropkick Murphys could do. We're happy to have Leighton here. Thanks so much for coming in today. We really appreciate it. One last question before moving on to the last segment here with Bill. You and I and so many in GEO have been involved in solidarity work, and we've developed a solidarity vigil here where we're doing various things, especially even around the clock of staying at the Y, but doing so many different actions on campus, showing labor films, having different protests, meeting with different groups. And that's been going on for a few weeks, and it's, I think, had a lot of successes. But where do you think that we in GEO, but just I think in general, we – in solidarity here in Illinois with the workers in Wisconsin and really in all these other states in Indiana and Ohio and in other places need to go in order to properly build the kind of solidarity network and effective counter-mobilization to this real right-wing push that we've seen. What do you think about this, Leighton?
Well, first, Jason, I want to thank you for organizing the movie nights at the Solidarity Vigil. Those have been great films you've been selecting, and I really appreciate that. Well, the question you ask is sort of the big question, isn't it? It's hard to sustain a vigil when it's a solidarity vigil, when it's not related to something that's happening in your locality or to you. And I think the stuff that we've done is great, and I want to give a big shout out to the GEO members who have been there. But now we have to look for other strategies, and I think that's the case in Wisconsin too. And it's we're also part of that debate at socialistworker.org. Our newspaper has been and website have been talking about strike and general strike, and is the recall campaign the right way to go, or are people looking to the have the Democrats sort of overcome their has labor overcome its reticence to the Democrat in recent years? And I think the thing that we have to say is that labor still needs an independent voice in this, that we can't depend on the Democrats, because while Walker is giving us a full frontal assault in Wisconsin, and we're seeing the same sort of thing in Indiana and Ohio, in Illinois we're getting decapitation by 1,000 cuts from the Democratic governor here, and that those cuts are still coming through. They're still going to mean the same thing in the long run. It just might take us longer to get there. And we need to stop, throwing our money to the Democrats and organizing independently as labor, and stop, campaigning for them. We have to have our own party, our own voice. I think here at the University of Illinois, the GEO needs to look at how do we take the great spirit of what's been happening in Wisconsin, translate that into our struggle here at the University of Illinois, where we have a university president who makes an obscene amount of money, $620,000 a year, which was more than the last crook who had the job. And they're still asking, us to do more with less. And they're going after the service workers right now. They're trying to cut out their jobs. How can we support the service workers? How do we as the GEO connect up with the other unions on campus to take this fight back? How do we make this up? Because we're public sector workers. You really have to look at it. It's a public university. We do, work that supports education, as do the service workers, as do the other folks on campus. How do we fight back against what's really a national attack on public sector employees. And that's going to mean we have to step up our fight in fine and applied arts to get the tuition waivers reintroduced. We start bargaining next year. Our contract expires in a year and a half. We're already thinking about bargaining. What can we do in the meantime to you know, beef up that bargaining, get members more motivated? And how do we link up our contract with the contracts of the service workers and the other unions on campus? Because right now they expire at different times. My dream is that we have coordinated bargaining, that we have coordinated contract expiration, and that we put a little power back into the labor movement, the sort of things we saw from a century ago, or, you know, well, 80 years ago in the 30s and the 40s in the heyday of the union, when much more militant and class-conscious unionism. We need to bring that energy back in and combine that with the great stuff that's been going on in Wisconsin and Indiana today.
Excellent. Leighton, thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks, guys. I've had a great time.
And I think we're going to go to Bill. He had some comments there.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I just want to advise you of a couple of things I found here recently. And one is called the Wobbly Times, and it's a blog. It's at wobblytimes.blogspot.com. That's wobblytimes, one word, .blogspot.com. And it's written by a member of the Call for General Strike group, Facebook group. I hate the name Facebook. It does seem like something that Zuckerman would think of after I've seen his picture.
Maybe that's why that virus was titled Coop Face or something.
Yeah. Anyway, getting back to this. Anyway, the Wobbly Times is written by a Mike Ballard, who's a member of the Call for General Strike group on Facebook, and it's not an official IWW publication, but he's got a long history as an activist and worker. And anyway, he had a link to an episode called What is a Wage Slave that I was looking at here. So you might want to look at wobblytimes.blogspot.com. Something else I wanted to mention, too, is, and actually this is sort of a blast from the past, which is the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, which I hope to probably talk about or perhaps interview people involved with sometime in the future. Back around 10 years ago, Peter and I used to get a lot of material from the LRNA, and they were based in Chicago, and they had a pretty good website. And I hope that they find a lot of this stuff off the old website, which was audio materials and so on, too, and get them incorporated in their new website. It seems like they're just starting back over again. And even though it's not on their website, which is lrna.org, they're having a convention in Detroit on the weekend of April 9th, which I know about through some friends on Facebook. And speaking of that, I want to say hi, Linda. And it's their idea, the basic idea of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America is that we are changing from sort of the industrial age where we had what they describe as people working with electromechanical help to a completely digital age where everything is pretty much completely automated. And thus we have a large class of sort of underemployed people, part-time people, unemployed people, and it's just going to keep growing. And what their ideas are about are what we need to do to face that, what kind of society that we need to try and build to deal with that reality. I'll call it, you know, you don't want to call it potentiality or eventuality. It is a reality. Yeah. Folks, 10% official unemployment is the new norm.
Yeah.
This isn't like back in the 90s in the George Bush, H.W. Bush recession, where it was like, well, gee, we don't know if we want to let unemployment get below 6% or we'll have inflation. Well,